Chapter 13, Tailoring Expectations. Bread and butter issues are more important to islanders than a general debate on whether the development plan has been good or bad. Alex Campbell, April 3, 1974, announcing an April 29th general election.
The changes implied in tailoring our expectations and adjusting our economic and social structures to live within our means require extensive and cooperative efforts, along with a full understanding of the issues on the part of both government and the public. Alex Campbell, Tailoring Our Expectations, Technology for People Conference, University of New Brunswick, May 13, 1977.
By the fall of 1973, Alex Campbell and his governing Liberals were anticipating their third election. While there was intermittent speculation about an early election call, Campbell ended the suspense in mid-October when he declared that there would be no vote in 1973. Campbell preferred the spring and a full 4 years. Moreover, there were political and economic considerations that required maturing before it would be time to go to the polls. The outlook for Campbell's Liberals was buoyed by Ben Crowe's third survey of PEI political attitudes, conducted in September of 73. Crowe found that the government had rebounded to 57.2% in voter support, and that 77% of respondents to the survey rated economic times as very good or fairly good. For a government preparing to seek a third term in office, the survey confirmed that the Campbell Liberals were in good political shape.
Prelude to the 1974 election.
In November 1971, George Key had announced that he would step down as leader of the Prince Edward Island Progressive Conservatives following his party's defeat in the 1970 election and his failure to win a seat in his second Prince riding. While there was plenty of speculation about possible contenders, including MPs David MacDonald and Angus MacLean, MLAs Lloyd MacPhail and Bennett Carr, and others who declined preemptively, such as George Dewar and Heath Macquarie, Mel McQuaid was the only candidate as at the PC Leadership Convention on February 3, 1973. A lawyer from Surrey, McQuaid served as Provincial Treasurer and Attorney General during Walter Shaw's first mandate and was twice elected as a federal MP. Outgoing leader Key cautioned the delegates at the convention, "We can depend on the Liberals to begin tomorrow to tear down your new leader. I know what I'm talking about because I've experienced it myself. I call on all of you to stand solidly behind your leader. If you don't, the whole exercise today will be in vain." Key went on to call for party loyalty and note that there were some prominent members of the party who are conspicuous today only by their absence. Mel McQuaid promised the people of the province a fair deal and a square deal. The negotiation of Phase 2 of the Comprehensive Development Plan did not line up smoothly with the 1974 election. As stipulated by the original CDP agreement and required by the Joint Advisory Board, evaluations of Phase 1 of the plan were underway and were a necessary stepping stone to establishing the details and priorities of Phase 2. Some preliminary evaluations were obtained by the media and by the opposition, including a report that suggested that the impact of the agricultural programs under the plan was not yet evident. Campbell dismissed the concerns and refused to release the preliminary studies on the grounds that they were not complete, that there were more studies to come, and that they had not yet been considered by the Joint Advisory Board. Still, it was not an ideal time to be campaigning on the plan. The Liberals had already decided, based on the findings of the Ben Crowe studies, to downplay the plan and campaign on a platform of action. In January 1974, opposition leader Mel McQuaid raised questions about two land transactions involving businessmen who were well-known Liberal supporters. Harry McLaughlin had purchased the Gregor's Hotel property adjacent to the Prince Edward Island National Park at Brackley Beach for $145,000 and sold it for $175,000 2 weeks later to the Land Development Corporation, which was acting as agent for the national park. John Skinner sold 63 acres of farmland in East Royalty to the Prince Edward Island Housing Authority, which wanted the property for the Hillsborough Village development, at a profit of $175,000. Campbell acted immediately, announcing on February 1st that Chief Justice St. Clair Traynor would conduct a commission of inquiry into the transactions. McQuaid questioned whether the property transactions might be only the tip of an iceberg. Campbell, when asked about the likelihood of the matter becoming an election issue, commented wryly, "Icebergs tend to melt in spring." He viewed the issue more in reputational than electoral terms, adding, "The public will not tolerate a dishonest government, nor would I want to be associated with one." Campbell showed confidence that the inquiry was not going to uncover any bombshells, calling the election while the commission was still conducting its 4 days of hearings. The inquiry hearings were uneventful, and the matter was barely mentioned during the election campaign. Chief Justice Traynor's report, which found no wrongdoing, was tabled in the legislature in early June. Economic considerations favored Campbell's Liberals in 1974. The government was in a good position to run on its fiscal record, having recorded a string of 5 consecutive balanced budgets. Moreover, they were reducing taxes. Earl Hickey's 1973 spring budget featured lower property tax rates. In November 1973, Premier Campbell announced that all clothing, footwear, and sportswear would henceforth be exempt from provincial sales tax, just in time for the Christmas shopping season. If a further electoral boost were required, it came with the 1974-75 provincial budget, which forecast total spending of $150 million and an operating surplus of $450,000. The budget introduced additional tax breaks on several fronts, including a further reduction in the property tax rate, plus sales tax exemptions on books, materials used to make clothes, soaps and cleaning supplies, and an exemption of up to $1,000 on household supplies purchased by newlyweds within 1 year of marriage. The province's ability to lower property tax rates and offer sales tax exemptions in 1973 and 1974 was aided to a significant degree by a 1973 change in the national equalization formula to take account of municipal taxes imposed for local school purposes. Because Prince Edward Island was already collecting these taxes at the provincial level, the change produced an increase of almost $5 million annually in the province's equalization transfers starting in 1973-1974. With a provincial budget of $153 million, an extra $5 million went a long way. What's more, the island economy was at an historic high. Firm cash receipts almost doubled between 1972 and 1974. Islanders' per capita incomes rose from more than $2,500 annually in 1972 to more than $3,700 in 1974, a remarkable 50% improvement in the space of 2 years. Provincial GDP grew from $286 million in 1972 to $424 million in 1974, a jump of 55%. Jobs were being added to the economy throughout Canada as the national unemployment rate dropped to 5.3% in April 1974 and Prince Edward Island's rate hit 8.8%. The darkest cloud on the economic horizon was inflation, with the consumer price index rising by 7.8% in 1973 and tracking upward at the same pace in 1974. As the legislature proceeded through its 1974 session, it was clear that an election was in the air. The Liberals planned to stick with a winning formula. The core team returned, with Mike Sturman as campaign manager, and Andy Wells, Sid Green, Bill Beliveau, and Bill Morrison continuing in their accustomed roles, while Jack McAndrew assumed a more active part. The group met regularly at the Longworth Avenue apartment starting in the fall of 1973. Alex Campbell's greatest concern going into the election was to urge Liberals against complacency, for which he blamed the loss of 2 previously Liberal seats in 1972 by-elections. The legislature opened on March 7th with a longer-than-normal speech from the throne, offering better housing, programs to bolster agricultural production along with tourism and the fishery, action on recommendations from the Advisory Council on the Status of Women, energy justice, industrial development, an increase to the minimum wage, and lower taxes. The traditionally conservative Guardian greeted the throne speech with an editorial headed, "Can't Knock It," saying, "There is little doubt that the Campbell government has aimed its sights in the right direction with its horn of plenty." The legislature met for less than a month. On April 3rd, Premier Campbell announced that there would be an election on April 29th. The campaign period complied with the minimum 26 days required by the Election Act. In comments to the media, Campbell prefigured the Liberals' election posture, noting, "Bread-and-butter issues are more important to Islanders than a general debate about whether the development plan has been good or bad." In February, when asked what he thought the election issue would be, Campbell said, I've always found that jobs and wages are priority items for islanders. I think that jobs, wages, and inflation will remain major concerns.
The campaign.
The Liberals got a jump start on the Conservatives, holding a big kickoff rally at the Prince County Vocational High School 2 days after the election was announced. The Conservatives held their kickoff rally the following Wednesday at Montague Regional High School, where they unveiled their campaign slogan, People Count. The Conservatives' most interesting platform plank was a promise to nationalize Maritime Electric, if necessary, to keep electricity prices down. In the course of the campaign, Conservative leader Mel McQuaid did his best to press the right buttons, attacking the Liberals for relying too much on the cancerous bureaucracy of red tape that threatens to engulf us all, and for not disclosing preliminary assessments of the development plan. The Liberals adopted the slogan, Action Now and for the Future. The platform consisted mainly of the initiatives proffered in the 1974 speech from the throne. Campaign advertising focused on specifics, such as the Family Farm Program, and especially on Alex Campbell and the Liberal team. In 1974, 20 of the 24 Liberals who held seats in the legislature at dissolution ran again. While that didn't leave much room for new blood, there were some notable new players, such as Catherine Colbeck in 4th Prince, George Proud in 5th Queens, and George Henderson in 2nd Prince. Campbell had approached Joe Giz, a young lawyer and Liberal Party activist, about running in one of the Charlottetown seats, but Giz had declined on the grounds that his first child was about to be born and that he and his law partners were building a new firm. There was no leaders' debate, with Conservative leader Mel McQuaid stumbling over a decision not to take part in a proposed debate at UPEI, saying that the students would have to come to Conservative rallies if they wanted to know where he stood on the issues. Alex Campbell was on top of his game throughout the 1974 campaign. He travelled to all parts of the province, much of the time in a large cream-coloured motorhome. Marilyn accompanied him at rallies. While the party platform had a something-for-everyone quality, such as to fight the cost of living or more good housing, Campbell spoke most often about the electoral planks that focused on the traditions and scale of Prince Edward Island, such as the Family Farm Program or policies aimed at strengthening the fishery. Campbell promised land policies that would combat vertical integration in agriculture and that would ensure that land is used in the best way to achieve the most good for the province. The newspaper headline following his speech to the Liberal nomination meeting in 3rd Prince was Premier Champions Island Way of Life. There was a series of Campbell days, with the Premier spending a full day in each of the 16 electoral districts. The Saturday that Campbell spent in the 4th Queen's District would be a typical one, with a total of 14 stops at seniors' homes, crossroads stores, farms, and wharves. At the Senior Citizens Club in Uig, Campbell's arrival was greeted with a round of, "For he's a jolly good fellow," and as he departed, Campbell led the group in singing, "This land is your land."
This land is your land, this land is my land, from Bonavista to Vancouver Island, from the Arctic Circle to the Great Lake waters, this land was made for you and me. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
It was that kind of a campaign. Following an energetic day in a Charlottetown district, visiting shopping malls, an elementary school, seniors' homes, a meatpacking plant, and a railway repair shop, the Evening Patriot headline was, "Premier sees no main issue in current voting campaign." The campaign deliberately built on Campbell's one-on-one strength, and he responded magnetically when interacting with people. At one stop at a Charlottetown elementary school, he exchanged campaign buttons with two teachers who were NDP candidates. Campbell knew them both personally. One of the NDP candidates, Harry Kiley, would later become an active Liberal. At every opportunity, Campbell stressed the need for Liberal workers to get out the vote and to not be complacent.
The third mandate.
The Liberals captured 26 seats in the legislature to 6 for the Progressive Conservatives. They took 54% of the popular vote, to 40% for the Conservatives and 6% for the NDP, which had mounted its first island-wide campaign. Conservative leader Mel McQuaid conceded that his party's emphasis on involving citizens more in the decision-making processes of government had not raised much enthusiasm among voters. Post-election commentaries expressed surprise at the scale of the Liberal victory and credited Alex Campbell's popularity and the intensity of his campaign as leader. One editorial concluded by saying that the Liberals owed their success to Campbell, noting, "He owes no political favors to anyone, because without Alex Campbell's personality, hard work, and sacrifice, the Liberal Party in this province would not be what it is today." For Campbell, it was an historic achievement to lead the second government in Prince Edward Island history to win three consecutive mandates, and the first in the 20th century to do so. In a post-election interview, Campbell coolly summed up what had taken place. "I think the results indicate clearly that people do vote for the leader when there's no overriding issue." On the day following the election, Alex Campbell indicated that he expected a major cabinet shuffle, saying, "I promised the voters a new government, and that's what they're going to get." Of the pre-election cabinet, all except Minister of Highways and Public Works, George Ferguson, had run and been re-elected. In selecting his new cabinet, Campbell had an impressive talent pool of fresh faces and proven veterans. Earl Hickey remained in finance, and John Maloney as Minister of Development, as well as Industry and Commerce. Bennett Campbell continued as Minister of Education, in addition to becoming Provincial Secretary. The ever-capable Bruce Stewart moved to Highways and Public Works. There were five newcomers. Businesswoman Catherine Colbeck was named Minister of Health and Social Services. Gilbert Clements came into Cabinet as Minister of Environment and Tourism, as well as Community Services. Veterinarian Dr. Bud Ings became Minister of Agriculture. George Henderson, who had upset the legislature's longest-serving member, Dr. George Dewar, in Second Prince, took on the dual portfolios of Fisheries and Labour. George Proud, who had served as President of the Prince Edward Island Federation of Labour, became Minister without portfolio, with responsible for the Prince Edward Island Housing Authority. Alex Campbell took on the role of Minister of Justice and Attorney General. Four members of the pre-election cabinet were not reappointed: Gordon Bennett, Robert Campbell, Jean Canfield, and Bill Gallant. While these were not easy decisions, they reflected Alex Campbell's best judgment about how to deploy the talent in his caucus. Campbell disclosed the new cabinet alignment in an unconventional manner, letting everyone know at a caucus meeting. With the extent of change involved, he apparently felt that this was the only way to break the news. The three newly elected cabinet ministers, Colbeck, Henderson, and Proud, were caught by surprise. George Henderson had to call home to Tyne Valley to ask his wife Brenda to bring a tie for the afternoon swearing-in at Government House. George Proud was in shock, thinking, "I didn't know if I could do that or not." Catherine Colbeck was the most shocked. Bruce Stewart offered to remain as Minister of Health until October, in addition to his new role in Highways and Public Works, while Colbeck initially took on Social Services. It is a measure of Stewart's capacity and good nature that, on top of doubling up his cabinet roles, he was a critical mentor to all three newcomers.
Phase 2 of the Development Plan.
In early November 1974, Alex Campbell addressed a post-election session of the PEI legislature, presenting the outlook for the second phase of the Comprehensive Development Plan, which was still under negotiation with the federal government. He said that the province had come a long way since 1969, noting increased employment, improved productivity in agriculture, dramatic gains in housing, significant capacity building in the public service, major investments and structural reforms in education, and needed infrastructure investments, notably on trunk and key secondary highways, along with school construction. The proffered scenario for Phase 2 of the plan was in part a logical extension of Phase 1, such as an emphasis in agriculture on supporting new and young farmers and on product marketing, and an emphasis in tourism on encouraging tourists to visit a wider diversity of island locations and on strengthening aspects of the tourist industry which are unique to Prince Edward Island. School construction would continue to be a priority, as would housing programs and highway infrastructure. Campbell announced that the province would seek support for a shopping list of provincial priorities termed once-in-a-lifetime needs, including a new referral hospital, a new jail, and a new provincial courthouse. While not conceding any failing in public participation, Campbell indirectly acknowledged criticism in some evaluation reports, saying, the government has remained very much aware of the need to include the public in the planning and development of programs. The 1969 plan was built around the logic of economic rationalization and productive advantages of scale, particularly in agriculture and the fishery. These combined with strategic needs of capacity building or modernization in education, tourism, the public service, housing, and transportation. Through experience, the plan's initial logic had to adapt to the realities of Prince Edward Island's scale, identity, and politics. In his November 1974 address, Alex Campbell melded the plan with these realities, declaring, "The basic objective of the plan is to increase income and to distribute it more evenly, while at the same time complementing to the fullest extent possible the special quality of life of Prince Edward Island." By 1974, the province was no longer in the dire fiscal straits of the 1960s. In the broader society and economy, the baby boomers who had been students in the education system that was under active renovation in the 1960s were now holding down jobs, starting families, building homes, and contributing to a growing consumer economy. In 5 years, starting in early 1970, a total of $105 million was spent under the plan's housing programs, the majority of it private money. In agriculture, 1973 and 1974 were the best years Prince Edward Island farmers had ever seen. Since the introduction of the Family Farm Program in 1972, $15.5 million had been invested. The areas where the province sought new or enhanced emphasis in the second phase of the development plan included fisheries to fund a license buyback program, land use and ownership to support the newly established Land Use Commission and various pilot projects and land assembly initiatives, and industrial development. At a meeting of the Joint Advisory Board in late November 1974, Minister of Development John Maloney made the case that the Phase 2 objectives were the same as for Phase 1. He said that the objective was to raise per capita income with equity, but without spoiling the environment. He went on to say that the province sought comparatively more emphasis to be placed on industry with its higher wage rates and greater technology. At the same time, the problems of the primary sectors will be tackled with imaginative programs. Alex Campbell told the legislature that his government would be examining industrial possibilities which are clean, labor-intensive, and compatible with the island way of life. Campbell looked upon negotiation of Phase 2 of the development plan and his relations with the federal government with confidence. He told the legislature, "In our years of experience, we have learned more about the policies of Canada, and we have been able to influence their application to our province to our advantage." From Campbell's perspective, it helped that Newfoundlander Don Jameson was Minister of Regional Economic Expansion, a post that Jameson had held since the 1972 election. Jameson was a cabinet heavyweight and knew both the island and Campbell well, having served as Prince Edward Island's regional minister at the time the CDP was signed in 1969. It was also advantageous that senior federal officials met regularly with Campbell, his ministers, and PEI bureaucrats through the Joint Advisory Board, which was co-chaired by Campbell and DREE Deputy Minister Doug Love. Notwithstanding these favorable conditions, negotiating the second phase of the development plan was not easy. The federal government was concerned about growing deficits and nervous about long-term commitments. It was only prepared to commit funding for the first 2 years. The process was complicated by the fact that DREE was in the process of putting in place general development agreements with the other Atlantic provinces, and that DREE viewed Phase 2 of the Comprehensive Development Plan as the equivalent for PEI. The federal side pushed back against Prince Edward Island proposals that were out of step with what was done for other provinces, such as in industrial development. From the provincial perspective, inflation was a problem. The $100 million that the federal government earmarked in 1969 for later phases of the development plan represented substantially less spending power by 1976. Ironically, while the province negotiated ferociously for a higher level of federal commitment, one of the most difficult negotiating points concerned ceilings on the amount of unspent annual allocations under Phase 1 of the CDP that could be carried forward. This was an issue throughout the life of the Comprehensive Development Plan and was particularly challenging in 1975-76 as the Phase 2 negotiations extended into the fiscal year. The Phase 2 agreement was finally signed on October 23, 1975, between Campbell and newly appointed DREE Minister Marcel Lessard. The federal government committed to $25 million in funding for year one and $27 million for year two, with terms for a further 3 years to be determined later. The fanfare of 1969 was a long way in the past, as Premier Campbell commented to reporters that the second phase would see no startling revolutions in the province. Campbell said that his greatest concern was for the future of Dree. Lessard acknowledged that negotiating the financing of the agreement had been difficult, commenting, "Costs are always a major factor on maritime programs." Both sides emphasized that private sector development would be a priority during the plan's second phase. The Joint Advisory Board met the day of the signing and approved 1975-76 spending, with the lion's share of expenditures going to school construction, $10.6 million, new farmer and new family farm programs, $5.5 million, highways, $2.5 million, industrial development, $2.3 million, environment, $1.8 million, land adjustment, $1.5 million, tourism and conservation, $1.2 million, housing, $1.1 million, and urban development, with $1 million.
Industrial development, PEI style.
In late 1974, Alex Campbell outlined his vision for Prince Edward Island industrial development, saying that he was not aiming to attract major development, making reference to New Brunswick's large-scale failure with the Brickland car manufacturing plant, and undoubtedly having in mind the not-too-distant specter of Georgetown Industries. Instead, Campbell said that PEI was hoping to attract smaller-scale enterprises, such as home office insurance operations, citing the example of Bermuda, built around actuarial expertise, or processing and small manufacturing operations to complement the fishing and agricultural sectors. He especially emphasized his desire for PEI to attract, as part of its industrial development agenda, aspects of what Campbell called the multi-million dollar industry based on government, scientific, and industrial research. A group of provincial civil servants and a United States consultant had spent the previous year investigating 24 likely areas of scientific research that could be a good fit with Prince Edward Island. Campbell offered as an example the possible establishment of a national center to study coastal land use and ecology, declaring, "A research program will be developed in Canada. Why not in PEI?" Campbell believed this research expertise could become part of a new island brand, saying, "It took at least 5 years for PEI to develop its identity as a center of the dramatic arts, and it would take at least that long to become established in the public mind as a center of research." Campbell's vision of building industrial development around smaller players took its most visible physical shape through two new industrial parks in West Royalty and Summerside, which opened in 1975. Industry Minister Dr. John Maloney predicted that the parks would create an estimated 200 jobs and an additional output of over $3 million annually. He looked forward to establishing a firm base of diversified light manufacturing on PEI, adding the qualifier, "with all things being equal and aggressive promotion." The industrial parks would become as well known for their failures as for their successes. Federal and provincial incentives were used to lure firms making aircraft and automobile parts, optical frames and sunglasses, Italian-styled kitchenware, and several metal fabricators, including a maker of collapsible steel household shopping carts. Some of these companies went through one or several bankruptcies before achieving success, and several disappeared shortly after the incentives ran out. The most sustained success came from growing or relocating firms with indigenous roots, such as Holland Stavert's machining operations, which relocated 33 employees from downtown Charlottetown to the West Royalty Industrial Mall, or Siemens Beverages, also relocated from downtown. Diagnostic Chemicals, a startup manufacturer of specialty fine chemicals and diagnostic reagents, relocated from an abandoned garage. Looking back on the period, Dr. Regis Duffy, the founder of Diagnostic Chemicals, describes the 1960s as the messianic era in industrial development, when governments were looking for outsiders to come in and convert the province to a modern industrial state. Duffy says that Alex Campbell was fundamentally different. He was really very entrepreneurial in terms of ideas, always open to exploring and learning about ideas. That's the essence of entrepreneurship. Alex was a risk taker when it came to ideas. Plus, he had an integrity and credibility about him. He was a lot more open than most politicians. Alex would sit down and listen. A lot of information that goes into most politicians just goes sideways. It's never digested. Alex Campbell's economic development vision was underpinned by two big ideas. that Prince Edward Island and Atlantic Canada should be focusing on smaller business and new or indigenous technologies, and that the goal should be greater self-reliance. This latter theme, which drew upon a small C conservative core of Campbell's nature, was featured in his November 1974 address to the provincial legislature. Campbell concluded by stating, "I fully realize that in the long run, strong individuals, cohesive families, and vital communities and institutions are essential to the fabric of our society. The ability of these units within our social structure to identify and solve problems, to identify and take advantage of opportunities, and to cope with present and emerging world crises as they affect Prince Edward Island and Prince Edward Islanders is of paramount importance." Campbell emphasized in his 1974 address and on numerous occasions during his tenure as Premier the agency of citizens, communities, institutions, and businesses, and the need to tailor expectations.
The role and attitudes of government.
Campbell's call for greater self-reliance and his emphasis on smaller business and a decentralized economy were closely interwoven. Moreover, they were integral to his views on the responsibilities and capacity of government and on the position of the Atlantic provinces within Canada. In May 1977, Campbell shared his vision for development and his views on the appropriate role of government with a conference at the University of New Brunswick. His address was titled, "Tailoring Our Expectations, the Politics of Appropriate Technology."
I think most of you who live in this part of the country and who have given some thought to the economic position of Atlantic Canada within the framework of Confederation will agree that since Confederation, we have largely been on the periphery of growth and development. For much of the growth and development we have experienced, there has been an overwhelming reliance upon imported technology and imported resources. We have had some measure of success in transplanting development goals, in restructuring our economic, cultural, and social base. We certainly have been successful in raising the level of expectations held by governments, held by business, held by all segments of our society. However, in the process of becoming partially successful, we have created a need for continuing and growing subsidization in order to meet our expectations. We have reduced our level of self-sufficiency and self-reliance, and we have fostered an increasing loss of self-esteem and confidence in ourselves. Continuation of this approach can, in my view, only lead us further and further away from the goals of self-reliance and self-esteem.
Campbell told his Fredericton audience that from a politician's point of view, there were two fundamental approaches that might be taken. The first was characterized by Campbell as the historical path, seeking ways and means to create an industrial and economic base similar to that of Central Canada, and seeking increased subsidization and external support for activities and technological solutions not necessarily appropriate to the geographical and historical circumstances of Atlantic Canada. Campbell characterized this as the easy political route, because all politicians operate under a 4-year mandate, and such solutions almost always suggest quick action and immediate improvement. Campbell turned his attention to what he termed his second fundamental approach, which he characterized as perhaps the more difficult political option, involving government taking the people into its full confidence in considering long-term options and opportunities. Campbell added, "I often feel that in this respect, politicians and governments frequently are running behind the people in appreciating the direction which might best be taken." He concluded, "The dilemma faced by politicians in Atlantic Canada, at least those who have given the question some thought, is how can the transition from inappropriate development and resource use to appropriate development and resource use be best accomplished? These fundamental changes and adjustments are not ones which can be achieved simply by legislation or government edict. Governments do have ongoing responsibilities to the public which cannot be abruptly and dramatically dropped or adjusted. The changes implied in tailoring our expectations and adjusting our economic and social structures to live within our means require extensive and cooperative efforts along with a full understanding of the issues on the part of both government and the public. This, I believe, to be the first step which we must take. For without that understanding and without that cooperation, all our best efforts may be to no avail." In October 1977, Campbell expanded on his vision for small and indigenous business development in an address to the annual conference of the Canadian Association of Superintendents of Insurance when the group met in Charlottetown. With the title, The Promise of Smaller-Scale Enterprise, Campbell presented a tableau encompassing the role of government and an alternative to what he viewed as a centralization of the national and international economy. While this may seem at first glance an unlikely audience for such a review, Campbell was alert to the role of insurance in allocating risks and rewards in the economy and in the world of business. His words were not those of a risk-averse politician.
Speaking as a politician who started out in the 60s, I believe we were quite correct in our endeavor to create programs of equal opportunity. But regrettably, the approach we took had some negative side effects. The vacuum created by the propensity of the private sector to centralize, together with demands upon government to do something, resulted in more dependency upon government. Consequently, the size and role of government expanded significantly. I think, as far as the private sector is concerned, up until now, most entrepreneurs have been occupied making day-to-day decisions that had to do specifically with their own enterprises, and not many felt a responsibility for the cumulative effect of their decisions. But every time an industry was rationalized and jobs were transferred to head office or production to the central plant, the process of centralizing productive capacity, wealth, population and political power in the country was intensified. The apparent lack of a feeling of responsibility in the private sector ultimately resulted in political pressure for the governments to create jobs. But governments involved themselves in joint ventures, encouraging the building of big food processing plants, enticing automobile manufacturers from Europe, developing big manufacturing plants that would employ large numbers of workers. But when one of these businesses experienced difficulties and ceased operations, as was not unusual, sometimes hundreds of families were left without a means to earn an income. Their choice was to accept unemployment insurance or welfare and take their chance that they would find other employment, or move elsewhere and take their chances. In an attempt to correct these structural weaknesses in its economy, the government of Prince Edward Island embarked some time ago upon a program to assist and attract small businesses. Our objective was to diversify and stabilize our local economy. Although we acknowledge the importance of our primary industries, we nevertheless recognize no society can be self-sufficient if it is overly dependent upon catching things and growing things. If a society wants to become more self-reliant, it must make things.
Vision to action.
As an incoming premier in 1966, Alex Campbell might have questioned whether the province's economy was predestined or to what extent it could be changed through public policy or governmental initiatives. Manufacturing comprised only 6.7% of the PEI economy in 1966, compared with 23.5% of Canada's national economy. Moreover, food-related manufacturing was by far the largest component, at about 70% of the PEI total. The biggest challenges to industrial development were that transportation was expensive and unreliable, and that Prince Edward Island's electricity costs were the highest in the country. The development plan identified manufacturing as a source of new jobs for people departing the restructuring primary sector, although that was not a priority until the mid-1970s. Between 1971 and 1981, the value added to the PEI economy by manufacturing increased from $22.4 million to $78.5 million, for an annual average growth rate of 13.4%, including inflation. This put Prince Edward Island slightly ahead of the average annual growth in manufacturing for Canada as a whole for the decade. PEI also saw a gain in manufacturing productivity during the latter part of the period, rising to 71% of the Canadian average by 1982, from 57% in 1975. Even with these growth indicators, Prince Edward Island did not make major gains in restructuring its economy toward manufacturing during the Campbell years. The most dramatic developments were in food processing, led by the rationalization of dairies and vegetable processors. Minister of Industry Dr. John Maloney acknowledged in 1975 that PEI was not attractive to heavy industry due to its lack of natural resources and the limited size of the labor force. However, Maloney added, we have ideal conditions for light industry to operate profitably, and this is the type that we are out to attract here to improve our economy. General Manager Rex Gross of Industrial Enterprises Incorporated emphasized that PEI's promotion of industrial and business expansion was based on a hard-headed approach that will bring about long-term sound development, saying that economic development was not a goose that delivers golden eggs by conveyor belt. It was not all about food processing or new technologies. There were, for example, 50 sawmills operating on the island in 1975, and there was impressive growth and innovation in manufacturing necessary goods such as farm machinery or fishing boats and equipment, and in woodworking and machine shops throughout the province. In December 1977, a senior team from the Department of Development held a seminar to begin brainstorming about Phase 3 of the development plan. They noted that 80% of industrial growth had come through the expansion of existing companies, and they foresaw both threats and opportunities in food processing. They speculated about Prince Edward Island's ability to attract head offices or to promote service industries. What was telling about the late 1977 seminar is how much of senior bureaucrats' thinking about industrial development remained speculative, and the extent to which senior people struggled to articulate the province's competitive niche. They knew that Prince Edward Island was still short of the development ideal espoused by Alex Campbell at the 1978 First Ministers' Conference, which was for islanders to be industrious, self-reliant, conserving people, employing advanced technology to manufacture useful goods.
The service sector and economic development.
The most dynamic part of the Prince Edward Island economy during Alex Campbell's time as premier was the service sector. In the 1970s, services were responsible for 80% of new job creation on Prince Edward Island and across Canada, and for 80% of total female employment. During the 1960s and 1970s, there was a significant shift in the composition of the Prince Edward Island labor force, from 50% of jobs being in goods production in 1961 to two-thirds of PEI jobs being in the service sector by 1981. The service sector is an amalgam of those parts of the economy that are not goods producing. It includes five components: finance, insurance, and real estate, wholesale and resale trade, community business and personal services, transportation and communications, and public administration and defense. All service sector components except transportation and communications grew faster than the total economy during the Campbell years. While finance, insurance, and real estate, and wholesale and retail trade saw the biggest growth between 1961 and 1981, public administration and defense continued to be the largest feature of the PEI economy, representing 20.4% of provincial GDP in 1981, the same as in 1961. The most striking feature of Prince Edward Island's economy, by comparison with Canada as a whole, was the relative weight of the public sector. Whereas public administration and defense constituted more than one-fifth of the PEI economy in 1981, it represented just 6.8% of Canada's 1981 national product. Urban development was not a significant factor in the minds of the planners and economists who conceived the Comprehensive Development Plan. By the early 1970s, Alex Campbell and his team realized that this was an oversight, in part prompted by the political desire to do something for Summerside in the aftermath of the decision to locate Holland College in Charlottetown. More broadly, there was a recognition that commerce and people were moving toward the larger centers, and that Charlottetown and Summerside both had substantial areas, notably their waterfronts, that were run down and ripe for more modern development. Because fisheries programs were slow getting out of the gate under the development plan, and because it was possible to fund fisheries initiatives through other, mainly federal programs, the $8 million identified for fisheries under the CDP was undersubscribed. Taken together with other discretionary funds under the plan, the province was in a position to earmark $5 million for the development of Summerside and Charlottetown, notably to upgrade and modernize waterfronts that were almost a century beyond their previous growth spurts. The Summerside Waterfront Development Corporation, or SWDC as it came to be known, was established in 1971, followed by the Charlottetown Area Development Corporation, or CADC, in 1973. These were independent entities with the provincial government as the dominant stakeholder, along with the municipal governments and local chambers of commerce. The Summerside Corporation initially focused on waterfront and West End land assembly and reclamation, and in 1973 acquired the Summerside Golf Course. The CADC focused initially on the rundown wharves, warehouses, and shipping facilities of the Charlottetown waterfront, and in 1978 opened Harbourfront, a mixed residential and commercial complex adjacent to the Charlottetown Yacht Club. The provincial government provided 75% of the funding and took a significant interest in the work of the urban development corporations, with Earl Hickey and Alex Campbell being involved in Summerside as the MLAs, and Dr. John Maloney taking an active part in the affairs of the CADC. Maloney was capable of speaking his mind, as he did at a Charlottetown City Council meeting. When legal objections threatened to delay a CADC development, Maloney erupted, "That's why the mafia killed their lawyers." Fred Hindman, who served on the board of the CADC for its first 10 years, says that there was no political interference during the Campbell years. There was pressure from the Premier's office to consider putting solar collector panels on the roof of Harbourfront, but the CADC board decided against it and its independence was respected. Hindman says that the first CADC board probably had a majority of Tories. He emphasizes that the initial vision of CADC and SWDC was that they would do sub-commercial projects and then eventually go out of business. Both the Summerside and Charlottetown Urban Development Corporations got involved in efforts to retain or attract consumer traffic downtown, but produced only modest results in the face of trends favoring suburban shopping malls. There were inherent controversies about how to square the public development mandate of the agencies with the forces of the market, with commercial landlords and developers complaining of unfair competition. Ironically, the established private sector operators also protected against what they called killer shopping malls and chain stores. In 1976, downtown merchants in Summerside protested that national chain stores stayed open in the malls on public holidays, while the downtown stores maintained the tradition of giving the employees the day off. This boiled into a larger controversy about the extent of mall development, leading to a commission led by UPEI professor Fred Driscoll. When the Conservative government under Angus MacLean came to power in 1979, their first measure was a moratorium on mall development. A secondary industry that did well during the Campbell years was construction, with companies and workers benefiting from both public and private investments. For each of the years 1966 through 1969, the total value of building permits issued on PEI was on average less than $5 million. By contrast, the years 1975 through 1978 saw an average of $70 million in annual permits, making construction a larger factor in the Prince Edward Island economy than either tourism or the fishery. Moreover, the value of building permits did not capture the value of heavy construction, such as roads, bridges, water and sewer, golf courses, or subdivision developments. While the most high-profile attention was given to large-scale construction projects such as schools or shopping malls, it is noteworthy that for the years 1975 through 1978, the value of residential construction permits totaled $145 million, surpassing $133 million for non-residential construction.
Tailoring a role for government.
In its third mandate, the Campbell government had to tighten its fiscal belt, as did governments across Canada and beyond. In his 1974 budget address, Provincial Treasurer Earl Hickey told the legislature, "We are surprisingly well off in this province, considering our very limited ability to impose our will on those beyond our shores." In May 1975, Hickey had more sobering news, projecting a deficit of $2.8 million and increasing taxes on cigarettes by 10 cents per pack. He warned that higher taxes on alcohol were not far behind. Hickey's main message was to call for government to exercise restraint and to curtail growth in the public service. As the development plan moved beyond the peak of federal contributions, the PEI government was increasingly challenged to match revenues with expenditures. In March 1978, Finance Minister Bennett Campbell presented a pre-election budget forecasting a deficit of $4.3 million, the largest during Alex Campbell's time as Premier. Throughout his years in office, Alex Campbell was willing to look critically at the economic status quo, including the role of government. As he approached 1978, Campbell was deeply focused on the essentials of finding a balance of prosperity, environmental stewardship, and quality of life. This required identifying useful, productive, and profitable things for Prince Edward Islanders to do, as they capitalized on the competitive advantage of scale inherent within Campbell's vision.